One of the big questions that I need to answer in trying to do this story, because I'm up here in a state network now as opposed to in Moberly, is kind of the extent of what happened in Moberly in 1983, but also what state impacts there were. And I guess the first question there is, when we talk about this incident, the word riot is used. Did this reach to the extent of a riot?
Well, I would say, there's a real fine line between the term riot and that being a serious disturbance. And certainly, without a doubt, it was a serious disturbance. It did not involve the entire prison population at the Moberly facility, but it certainly involved one of the main housing units, and a number of inmates were involved, and so it was quite serious. And I really have no doubt in my mind that had the staff that were on duty at the time not taken the action that they took, that it very possibly could have spread throughout the entire institution and it developed into a full-scale riot.
What was the time frame of that? When did it begin? How long did it last?
Well, as far as the exact hour, I can't remember after all these years, but it was on July the 3rd, 1983, and it started in the evening time, I believe, and I don't believe it was dark yet, but it actually started in a housing unit where a number of offenders were confined, and of course, Moberly is being a medium security facility, there's a lot more freedom. And the way the place is set up, there's a central atrium where the officers are located, and then there are various wings. And so an officer actually tried to go into a wing to remove inmates that were intoxicated, some of whom belonged to members of a group called the Aryan Brotherhood. And in so doing, the officer was restrained and ended up being stabbed fatally.
And that's when we talk about how serious an incident this was, regardless of what we're going to call it, that's what makes it a serious incident, isn't it?
Absolutely. Anytime you have a degree of violence with that intensity, whether it's against staff or offenders, it's a serious, serious situation and can certainly escalate into something that can get out of control very easily, because I think we have to remember that even today, as it was back then, almost 30 years ago, the inmate population basically outnumbered the staff. So you always have more inmates than you do staff available. And from what I can recollect back at that time, there were very few staff on duty for that entire facility. The superintendent, or the what we now call the warden, the superintendent at the time, was gone on vacation, as were other individuals. And so there was a very skeletal force of staff actually on duty for the entire institution. In fact, during my investigation, I found it rather astounding or even appalling, the few number of staff that were on duty for the Moberly facility at the time.
How did it come to be that you were in Moberly, one, and two, conducting the investigation?
Well, that was kind of interesting, because in that very year, in 1983, the department had talked for some time about starting an investigative branch. Now, I had been an investigator as such, kind of at the institutional level at the Missouri State Penitentiary, and of course had been with the prosecutor and the sheriff's office as a chief investigator for Cole County, which would cause me to be involved with investigations at the three prisons located in Cole County. So in 1983, I was appointed as the chief internal affairs officer, which encompassed investigations for the entire Department of Corrections. And I was stationed or was actually assigned to central office in Jefferson City. And so when that occurred, the zone director at the time, Mr. Dale Riley, I was contacted on that date and told to go to Moberly immediately, because there had been this incident that had occurred. Now, Moberly had an investigator at the time, Mr. Ray Newberry, and so I went up there. And of course, the sheriff of a county is the person that has responsibility for state property within their jurisdiction or county. So that was also true in Randolph County, where Sheriff Price at the time was the sheriff. But when I went up there, they had contacted a fellow named Sergeant Belshi. He came down from the Highway Patrol. And of course, I worked with the Department of Corrections. So we basically, augmented the resources that Sheriff Price had or didn't have. And he had very limited resources within his department. So I ended up taking photographs, interviewing offenders, worked throughout the night, interviewed a number of staff. The institution was on lockdown, but still quite tense. There was concern that there still might be major disturbances within the institution. So this was began on July the 3rd investigation, and it continued for many, many days thereafter.
Was there any concern when you first heard about an outbreak? I mean, it was 54 that probably the best known riot in the state's history had happened, but there had been other riots throughout the state's history. There had been other riots around the country. What was the atmosphere in the prison system like when you heard that there was a disturbance, and how concerned were you about what it would or could become?
Well, we were very, very concerned, and I mean both the people at the Mobley facility as well as the administrative staff from central office. We had been up to Moberly in 1980 for a work strike type situation that very clearly could have gotten out of hand at that time too. And it was extremely hot in 1980. I mean, well up into the hundreds. And I had gone up there as a member of the MSPE squad to help the Moberly staff manage the inmates going to and from meals and in the housing units, so on and so forth. So you always have to be concerned, because it makes no difference whether it's a minimum security facility or maximum security facility. If people get extremely upset and, things have been brewing for some period of time and the inmate population can get out of hand, then you're very concerned. Of course, you think about 54, and then there was one at MSP in 1930, and then at the time that I was at MSP during the 1970s, when we tried to integrate the Missouri prison system, those were real times of extreme violence, a lot of violence as well as escapes. And so, there was a lot of that going on, and so we were very, very concerned about the potential collapse of the entire facility up at Moberly. I mean, the patrol was involved in the 1983 event as well, helping, because the staff, there was concern that the staff might actually stage a walkout. Fortunately, they elected not to do so, but there was a lot of concern. And in one house in particular, I remember where the staff did leave that particular housing unit, and the inmates themselves, a couple of inmates called up and basically said, "Here's the count, and we've got everybody back in their cells." So the inmates themselves, some of them actually, got their fellow inmates to stay in their cells and then actually tried to take a count. And so we were really concerned that that whole thing could have blown up. And quite honestly, our concern back at that time, because we only had the one maximum security prison, and that was here in Jefferson City. And those people involved in the Moberly incident were sent down to MSP. Well, there's always concern that something might occur at another facility as a sympathy type event or whatever. And, of course, there's always that rumor mill that runs rampant about this happened or that happened, most of which, of course, turns out not to be true. But that can certainly get the inmate population upset as well. So you have to be concerned about all those factors.
And in the wake of what happened in Moberly, what was the tension level still there in terms of concern about another incident?
Absolutely. The tension level remained for some period of time. And, of course, the one difficulty was that the superintendent could not be reached. He was on vacation out of state. And So there was a lot of concern about supposedly that that the administration paid no attention to the problems within the institution and problems brought forth by inmates and so on and so forth. So there was a breakdown of the lines of communication between the staff and the offenders. Now, this isn't to by any means excuse the actions of the offenders, because clearly the people involved, the main individuals involved were members of the Aryan Brotherhood. They were intoxicated, and extremely violent. So, that was a concern. Okay, how far reaching and how far ranging is this? And will there be other individuals that would join in? So, that's why the investigation took some period of time. And Ray Newberry and the other individuals assigned with Ray up there, they continued this investigation for a long period of time after I had come back to Jefferson City. But I generated a number of reports during interviews of both inmates and staff that, Mr. Armantrout, who was also went up there, who later was the warden of MSP and then a zone director, assisted and as well as the patrol, and so it was a pretty broad investigation.
Based on your investigation, how did things unfold that night?
Well, basically, things unfolded from the standpoint of we basically picked up information later that actually the intention was to start some type of disturbance on July the 4th. Well, the inmates involved became intoxicated on July the 3rd, so they were a day early. And as I said, we later uncovered some photographs that showed some of these individuals. These were Polaroid-type photos that actually showed them holding up Aryan Brotherhood symbols, Aryan Brotherhood flags, that type of thing. Admittedly, one of the key individuals that was involved, he admitted that he was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. He had tattoos that indicated he was a member of the Aryan Brotherhood, and he had come from out of the state of California, and you don't wear Aryan Brotherhood insignia, markings, tattoos, unless you really are a member, because otherwise that'll get you a death sentence in a lot of prisons. So we were dealing with some pretty difficult people there, and so what happened when the officer went into this particular unit, and I can't remember for sure the house unit, but I believe it was 2 house. It may not have been, but I think it was. This officer, Officer Jackson, he and some others tried to go into the unit to remove the intoxicated inmates, and in so doing, the catcalls started and then some pushing and shoving. The next thing you know, the thing escalated. Somebody grabbed and held Officer Jackson, and the other inmate then stabbed him multiple times. And, of course, they were fatal. And then all heck broke loose within certain wings of that unit, and it ended up that the captain on in charge at the time, who was the highest-ranking person on duty, he basically said, okay, we're gonna get some weapons because we cannot get these inmates back into their cells, and they were breaking out of the wing into the atrium of the unit. And so they got weapons and shots were fired, and several inmates were hit with pellets that glanced and ricocheted, so on and so forth. And of course, one of the complaints made later was that the force used was beyond what was necessary. But it's always difficult to judge somebody based on that, because certainly with a small number of staff on duty, by the action they took, they were able to quell the disturbance and get the inmates back in their cells, keep them from breaking out of the housing unit. And so, I'm not going to try to second guess them there. They did the best they could at the time with the limited resources that they had.
And how quickly were they able to get in there and recover Officer Jackson's body?
Well, right offhand, I can't recall, but they got to him fairly quickly. They got to Officer Jackson fairly quickly, but I remember that there was a great deal of blood out in the atrium because there were other officers injured as well. Other officers had scrapes and cuts so on and so forth, contusions and abrasions and everything, because it was, it was pretty chaotic. But I do remember a very significant amount of blood that was out in the atrium, and I think the crime scene photographs showed that as well. So, but it was too late for Officer Jackson.
Now, I was going to ask you if I misspoke there, but I'm trying to remember if he or how long he survived after he was attacked.
Well, not long, because from what I recall, his injuries were he had a massive injury to one of his eyes, and that was a very severe injury where he'd been kicked or struck in the eye. And then he also had, multiple stab wounds in the chest area, which any one of which could have proved fatal. So, he was basically dead pretty quickly. He never made it to the infirmary. They got him to the infirmary, but he was dead before they ever got him to the infirmary.
Once the investigation was complete, then of course we started talking about criminal prosecution, and there were two individuals that seemed to have gotten the most attention out of this incident.
Right.
How did that unfold?
Well, it unfolded that during the course of interviews that were conducted by Ray Newberry and Sergeant Belshi from the patrol, who was an investigator, and Bill Armantrout and myself, that it unfolded in that basically we talked to a number of inmates who had varying degrees of responsibility and participation, and so and then also based on the accounts from staff as to what they saw and who they saw and so on and so forth, and eventually actual confessions were obtained, and particularly from the main perpetuator of the crime, and then of course we also had some physical evidence which we obtained based on the main inmate's statements that he made to us. Now, of course, later on, he wanted to recant some of the things, but he actually, excuse me, he actually gave us a statement and had been given his Miranda rights and everything like that. Later on, he wanted to, when he was transferred down to MSP for security reasons, he later on wanted to say that when it got close to time to go to trial, that the confession had been forced from him, but that absolutely was not true. Matter of fact, he had shown me an Aryan Brotherhood tattoo that he had on his chest, and that photograph was taken after he had given us a statement and after the interview, and right outside the interview room, and he pulled his shirt up, and when I photographed him, you could clearly see that his elbows were exposed, meaning that you could clearly see the underside of his elbows, and he later said that his one of his elbows had been fractured. Well, it was fractured because he did it to himself down at MSP after he'd been transported down there. And you could clearly see that there were no marks or bruises or contusions or abrasions or anything on his body. And so it was just fortunate that as luck would have it, I'd taken a picture of that Aryan Brotherhood tattoo on his chest, and it clearly showed that his elbows were fine, because he pulled his shirt up and you could see his elbows. There was absolutely nothing wrong with him. Well, he forgot that that photograph had been taken, but he tried to, at the first trial in particular, use that approach, and it didn't hold up. So, that's kind of how it was.
Well, the end result there, we ended up executing one man for that crime. Another one.
Yes, Roy Roberts, they referred to him as Hog Roberts, but the inmates did, his nickname. But Roy Roberts was the person that actually held Officer Jackson, and he was executed. And I can't remember right now what year that was. But then, of course, the other inmate, the main individual that was the main assailant, stabber, had multiple trials, and this was happened over a period of 20 years. And each time he got a new trial, it was based on some error in instructions that were given or whatever that resulted in him getting a new trial. And of course, you know, it was very, very frustrating because he was found guilty two times for sure. I can't even remember now whether we had three or four trials. I know we had three for sure. But anyway, you know, the change of venue was down to Phelps County, which would be Rolla. And the Attorney General's office, Bob Austins, who was a Deputy Attorney General, was the one that handled that, since it would help the prosecuting attorney, I believe Mr. Fusselman from up in Randolph County. And, you know, he got convictions, and then only to have those overturned by technicalities. And so finally, in the last trial, you know, here comes the main inmate. He's in a wheelchair, alleging that, you know, he's at death's door with this liver failure and all these things. And it ends up that about seven or eight of our key witnesses, and by the way, there were some inmates that testified against him, and the inmates had been released from prison. There were no deals made or anything like that. They just happened to be individuals that thought that Officer Jackson was a decent officer and he didn't deserve to die in the manner in which he died. And one fellow that came all the way back from, I believe, out in Colorado, was married, had some kids, had a very good job, came back and testified, even at the last, and wouldn't have had to done so. I mean, you know, he would not have had to return to Missouri to testify, but he did so. And, you know, it ended up that with those eight witnesses being dead, and when I say seven or eight witnesses being dead, basically they were staff witnesses that had been involved, key staff individuals. And so it basically ended up then that he was found guilty of manslaughter and then given credit for time served, basically, because now 20 years had passed, and he walked out a free man. And that was very, very frustrating based on the fact that he was, by his own admission, the individual that killed Officer Tom Jackson. And later on, that individual, I believe, was up in the area of St. Louis, and he was working supposedly as some kind of an assistant to attorneys, and actually had tried to go to an institution in the St. Louis area, and they had contacted us down at MSP and asked if we knew this individual by name. We said yes, and they said, well, he's trying to come in as an investigator, and I said, well, is he in a wheelchair? No, he walked in. And so there's the story, and haven't heard anything about him since, but he's probably still out there somewhere, and, you know, and he was responsible for Tom Jackson's death.
Now, are there others who were involved in that are still in the prison system?
Well, you know, I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't know who's in and who's out right now. I don't, because, you know, I retired in 2010, you know, with the change of duties that I had and so on and so forth, you know, having gone back to being the deputy warden at MSP, 2001, 2002, right around that time, then I lost track of everything and everybody. So I don't know what the status of those people are as we speak. You know, they may be in there somewhere.
In terms of the prison system and its operations, were there any lasting impacts or lasting results from what happened at Moberly, changes in procedure, anything like that?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because in what we would consider recent times, and it's ironic that that's now over a period of almost 40 years or so, I was the main individual that investigated the three homicides of the staff that had occurred in the Missouri prison system, starting with Harold Atkinson in 1975, Officer Walter Farrell at MSP in 1979. Atkinson was killed at MSP in 75, and then, of course, Tom Jackson in 83, and then we had a lot of serious assaults on staff with that resulted in very serious injuries. Some people had to retire because of their injuries. Officer Patrick Casey was stabbed at MSP, permanently paralyzed on one side, couldn't speak, and he did live for a number of years, but he was basically totally incapacitated, from being stabbed by a deranged inmate down there. But it always seems like that every time the Missouri Department of Corrections gets staff or equipment or things like that, it's always after some tragic event occurs or some major issue occurs. And it's no secret that the Missouri Department of Corrections started out as the lowest paid correctional entity in the United States. It's no secret that when I came to work there in 1968, they were the lowest paid, and it's no secret that today, as we speak right now, they're still the lowest paid from the top to the bottom of all the 50 states. And it's not that doesn't mean that they're the worst as far as being the way the prison system managed. In fact, quite to the contrary, Money Magazine several years ago said the Missouri Department of Corrections was one of the most efficiently run correctional agencies in the United States. And of course, we've built 20 facilities. Missouri wised up, I think, after 1983, in that when we built more facilities in the 90s, particularly, they built all of those as maximum security facilities. That way, you could basically transfer problem offenders from one facility to another, gang members or whatever they might be, and kind of keep them off balance. And so that made good sense because you can always give people more privileges based on their behavior in an institution. But once you build a facility as a minimum security facility, then you're going to have a difficult time going back to the General Assembly and securing funds to upgrade it to a medium or a max. So it just makes sense to build any facility as a maximum security facility. And Missouri has done some things right. So, they've had one homicide out at the new facility since it was built and opened in 2004. And that actually happened right in front of some staff. And that person just flat wanted to get somebody, that he didn't care whether he was seen or not. But the violence level, when you go back and look at, I was looking at some of the log books that my wife had kept from the prosecutor's office here. And when you go back and look, she's been up in the prosecutor's office for 36 years, and she's actually retiring today. But when you go back and look at the charges that were filed for the number of escapes and the violent acts against staff, offering violence to a correctional employee, offering violence to a correctional officer, weapons charges, those types of things, it was unbelievable the number of charges right here in Cole County, for example, that took place. And I'm assuming there were an awful lot of them that happened up in Randolph County. So right now, knock on wood, Missouri has been fortunate in that you do not read about Missouri corrections in the news like you used to all the time. And from 1836 until 1989, Missouri would not build another maximum security prison. And that's kind of an indictment, as far as I'm concerned, of the entire system, and particularly the General Assembly. And that after the 54 riot, it was recommended that the Missouri State Penitentiary be closed, and it took 50 years to close it. So, that tells you something about the violence level. So I don't want to just say that it was on Moberly, because it certainly wasn't, but I think there were some lessons learned by Moberly. One thing that was done, and I don't know if Missouri's still doing this or not, but Dale Riley, who's from up around Moberly, Huntsville's where he's from, Dale Riley and myself, we actually formed a group called C-STAR, and that was Correction Special Tactics and Response. And it was a highly trained tactical unit, because we realized that the E squads from the institutions, and the first E squad actually started at emergency squad actually started at MSP. And we realized that when, particularly after the Moberly incident, where we had to take resources from MSP to go up and help and assist the Moberly staff. We realized that things could get out of hand, because what if something then had started at MSP and there's your emergency squad some distance away and they're tired and hot and everything, and you don't have enough resources then to take care of the problem. You know, we had some disturbances out at Algoa where we had to go out there and assist them. So those are the kinds of things that you run into. And, you know, Missouri, I think, learned some lessons from both 54 and the Moberly incident and incidents at MSP as well.
All right. Is there now we've talked quite a while here. Is there anything else that you think we ought to cover about that incident that we haven't?
Well, I really don't know what it would be. I can certainly say that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, looking back, it was a real tragedy. It had a real impact on me, simply because of the fact that I felt that I don't think that justice was served. You know, I'm not blaming any particular entity for that. It was certainly something that time was on the side of the main perpetuator of that crime, and it played out in his favor. And it's in one way, I'm not diminishing the fact that the one guy held Officer Jackson, that Roberts did, but certainly when you look at that, Roberts was not the person that had the knife. He wasn't the stabber, and the stabber walked out a free man. So, you know, when you look at things that way, it's a little bit disturbing as to, well, why did it work out that way? So, you know, it is what it is, I guess.
Now, I'm going to offer this maybe to our Moberly affiliate, and I don't know if they'll use it or not, but they might be interested to know what else it is that you and I do at MSP now. If they are enjoying some of the historical perspectives that they're hearing from you, they might want to know what you do there.
Right. Well, of course, now, since I've retired in 2010, and like I said, you know, I had a 42-year career in criminal justice, and it wasn't just at the prison, although the biggest portion was, but with the Department of Corrections. But having been with the sheriff and the prosecutor's office, a big part of my job was to work crimes that occurred specifically in MSP or at Algoa or the Central Missouri Correctional Center, which then was called Church Farm, and the biggest percentage of that was at MSP, those crimes that occurred. But, of course, now, I basically started the prison tours for the Convention Visitors Bureau, and you're directly involved with that as well. And we're trying to make sure that people see the historical and sociological value of the old Missouri State Penitentiary, which, when it closed September the 15th of 2004, was the oldest continuously operating prison west of the Mississippi, having opened in 1836, the very week that the Alamo Battle was taking place. And, of course, Andrew Jackson was president of the United States. So, who knows? Maybe the bulldozers will run through MSP. It's starting to look more and more that way. But to me, it would be a real tragedy if that occurred, because it was such a significant piece, not just of the history of the city of Jefferson, but the history of the state of Missouri, and in some instances, United States history. So, I'm hoping that through the tours that we give and the emphasis we placed on the historical perspective of MSP, that can continue into the future. And there's a lot of lessons to be learned from MSP and Moberly. And Moberly certainly isn't a new institution anymore. It actually opened when I was in high school. And so, hopefully the history will continue, and hopefully we've learned from some of the mistakes that have been made in the past.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you, and I'll talk to you later.